This episode is brought to you by Bin to Table, a monthly food subscription service for folks who want to cook with the best pantry ingredients on the planet. Learn more at bintotable.com and use the code HRN at checkout to get $20 off your first month. This week on Meat and Three, we have stories about food in large quantities. From bulk buying groups and reasons for stocking up, to creative solutions for handling excess waste.
We have someone picking up our corks from the wine bottles, and they repurpose them to make buoys for boats and like shoes and all these different things.
Yeah, because of the COVID, everybody like isolate at home. But to see the people face to face is still exciting. So we kind of treat it like a chance to say hello to the people and to the friend.
Listen to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you get your podcast.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Rupert Symington. We'll talk to Rupert about Port, Porto, the Douro, Symington family estates, and a lot more. We'll taste a 20-year-old Tawny for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Rupert Symington is a fourth-generation port maker from a family of British and Portuguese origin dating back to the late 1800s. Rupert was educated in England and worked in finance there. Rupert Wade has made his way to San Francisco and Chile before returning to the family business in Porto and the Douro in Portugal. He is the CEO of Symington Family Estates, overseeing four of the leading port houses, including Graham's and Dow, along with 26 quintas or vineyards, making port and wine in the Douro and now in Alentejo. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Rupert.
Hi, Sam.
You know, you and I were supposed to sit down in person. I think it was in May. You had a pretty hefty U.S. tour with tastings and, you know, all kinds of market stuff. And obviously, because of COVID, everything was canceled. So we're doing a remote broadcast via Zencastr. And Rupert, you are currently in Portugal, right?
Absolutely. It was a great shame to have to cancel that great visit back in May. We were going to celebrate 300 years of Warren Company, one of our companies, and Graham's would have been 200 years old this year. But anyway, we had lots of celebrations, all canceled. But hey, here we are.
Yeah, trying to get back on our feet. All right, Rupert, I want to take a few minutes to talk about a few things. I want you to tell me about your journey in life in wine that got you currently to CEO of the family estate, Symington Family Estates. You know, so give me, I alluded a little that you were in Chile and San Francisco, but, you know, give me the whole route and chronology. And then I want you to give me a brief history of Symington so that when we get into everything, everyone sort of has a frame of, you know, what we're talking about. So start with how you got to where you are.
So I was born into a wine family, and my father was very much responsible for the export markets, including the United States. And I spent my early life at home. We a lot of our trade customers would actually stay at home with my parents, or we'd go out to dinner with them. So I remember having a wonderful trip to the Douro with a gentleman called Terry Robards, who was the wine columnist for the New York Times.
Yes. Great
gentleman. And we had so much fun. And so I grew up around the wines, around the vineyards. Back then, we were a much smaller business. We had many fewer properties in the Douro. But from my earliest memories, we're visiting Quinta de Bonfim at Pinhão, going up for the vintage. Children were allowed at the vintage to be seen but not heard. So we had to skulk around in the kitchen while the important trade visitors were entertained in the dining room. But it was, I have to say, I got to understand and respect the Douro from a very early age. As I progressed, I went away to school in England and university. I always had this intention, and my father sat me down when I was about 16 and said, "Look, you know, I inherited shares in this business from my father, and if you're interested, you know, I would like you to follow in my footsteps." And I said, "Well, look, you know, what do I have to do?" So I spent some time. I worked in finance in London. I went traveling in Australia. Met my wife in California. Did a business degree in France, and when I was about, I suppose, 28, I moved back full time to this city, and joined the business.
When was that? In the early 90s?
Came back full time. So I'd been away. I grew up. I was here till about 1977, and then I came back full time in 92. But obviously, meanwhile, I'd spent a lot of vacation time here, and you know, I hadn't lost touch at all with what was going on. And 92 was a very interesting time because we were changing a little bit as a business. We were looking more at going downstream into the vineyards, controlling more of our own production. And from 92 to 2000, we expanded really quite quickly. So there was lots to do. I started working with four of my cousins from my generation, plus four of my of the older generation. So we were a team of about eight or nine family members, but we have a sort of very good formula that we divide up the tasks between the family members, so none of us kind of tread on each other's toes. So I started, you know, I took over from my father the US market commercial responsibility. I also took over some of the family governance, you know, running the shareholder meetings and that sort of thing, which I enjoy. And as my older cousins gradually retired, I moved up the ladder, and I think my own skill, if you like, I've tried to keep abreast of every area of the business, not just, you know, one particular niche. So I've been trying to follow what's going on in production, following what's going on in bottling, in vineyard development, in wine stocks, etc. So I think I'm in quite a good position to be CEO because I do have a pretty broad vision of the company.
Right, that's what it takes, a knowledge of everything.
A lot of businesses of our sort, you know, they get to a point where they simply don't have the talent pool, and they have to, you know, bring in outside CEOs. And that's very common and very normal. I think we've been blessed, certainly in the fourth generation, my generation, we were blessed with four or five very able individuals, and I've really enjoyed working with my cousins. It's been a pleasure, you know, to have this common goal. We haven't had too many fights,
right? Which is usually the problem.
Yeah, I've just been watching Succession on Netflix, and
you bet. You know. Don't watch it.
it's a big responsibility. I mean, I think, you know, I became a director of the company back in the early 90s, and I haven't really progressed from a career point of view hugely, and that's the downside of a family business is that there's nowhere you can really go. But as long as you love what you do, and
that's an interesting insight. All right, so you know, a couple things. It's interesting because before you came back in 92, it sounded like a nice family business, with the family involved and some nice holdings. And as you alluded, I guess from 2000 on, the growth has been amazing and the holdings are amazing, you know, from brand names to property to the amount of quintas. And, you know, I hope we'll get into that a little. But before we start talking about, you know, specifically the wines and the areas, just, you know, give me a little family history. The Symingtons got into this The port business has been around longer than the Symington's, but the Symington's jumped into this, you know, take me from that, you know, to current.
So the first Symington came here in 1882, my great grandfather, Andrew James, and he was a young Scotsman. His family had been, you know, industrialists in Scotland. He was well educated, but he, unfortunately, there'd been a financial disaster, wiped out the family fortune. So he came out here pretty much without a penny to his name. Wow. To work for the Graham family, who were family friends back in Glasgow in Scotland. And Graham's at that time was a textile producer with a port arm. And he worked initially for the textile business, but he soon branched out. He didn't actually work. He left Graham's and went into the port trade. And he built himself a reputation. He did some deals for the government in to get rid of distressed port stocks. And he ended up buying from the War family, one of the oldest families in the port trade.
W-A-R-R-E, right?
Exactly. He took over their Oporto production branch, because back then a lot of port shippers had their offices in London and they had a production arm here. So he bought outright Wars in about 1912, and with it Quinta de Bonfim, which is still our family home and base in the Douro. And he had three sons who followed him into the business. They managed to buy out the Dow brand, from which was also, curiously enough, owned by the War family at the time. And by the 1950s, they owned these two brands. By the time I was born, it was Dow and War were our family brands. In 1970, my father and his cousins managed to buy Graham's, which was an icon of the port trade, particularly in the vintage port world. It was a brand that had been underinvested for a number of years. And it was a trophy. We had to do a lot of work and put it back on the map. So that's the third generation added the third brand, if you like. And then we were lucky enough in 2006 to be, we were approached by Beam, who'd recently bought the Coban Port brand as part of the Allied Domecq portfolio that they bought.
Ah.
And they approached us to set up a deal where we acquired the production assets and produced Coban's port for them. So they kept control of the brand, but we would take over all the stocks and the vineyards. So we took over all of the part that we were good at, which is, you know, winemaking, vineyard management, and they kept the brand. And then it was at the beginning of the financial crisis, they came back to us and said, well, look, you know, we're not really interested in this. This brand doesn't really fit our long-term strategy. You know, how about we go back to where we were in 2006 and what would you have offered us for the whole lot? So they basically sold us the brand.
Wow.
Which was great. I mean, and this was, you know, I have to say that this was the brand when I was a kid. These were the guys with the directors had the chauffeur driven cars and this was a bit.
It's funny you remember that. Yeah.
It's a bit like sort of, you know, I don't know, Dry Creek Vineyard buying Gallo. You know, it was a funny twist of fate, you know, that my grandfather had been a great friend of Reg Cobb, who's the owner and director of Coban's. And it was inconceivable that Symington would have ever been big enough to buy Coban's. But anyway, we ended up with a brand which, you know, with a lot of history. It's the biggest brand in the UK market, particularly, and has the iconic Special Reserve, which is probably the most widely sold brand in the reserve category. So we did take a big leap. It was a big financial leap as well. We had to borrow a lot of money, but it was, you know, I think, you know, looking back, you know, 14 years later, you know,
it was a good business decision.
It was I just rode up in the car just now with my cousin Paul, who's now retired, but he and I and our cousin Johnny, you know, the three of us put together the deal and, you know, delivered it to our shareholders. And I think it was one of the best things we ever did.
It shows you how an old, you know, port is definitely perceived by people as being around for hundreds of years, how the history, you know, the change in the acquisition is fairly current. I mean, you know, all this happened not that long ago. Rupert, I think I said this before. I don't think I could think of anybody better than you to help me and help my listeners get a little primer or education on how port is made. So before we get into, you know, the specific brands, I want you to help me, I don't think decipher, but explain about port. So let's start with the vineyards, all right? So people think of port as a drink from Porto in Portugal, but the vineyards are very unique and they're located east of Porto in the Douro, correct? Take me from there.
So originally when port was first made popular back in the end of the 17th century, port was generally known as a wine from the coast. And then as people's you know, consumption increased, they went up river, and about an hour and a half by car today, and what was then back then a day and a half by on muleback up the river, it's about 60, 70 miles up the river, they found these monks growing vineyards and grapes that had a much higher natural level of sugar. They were basically, there's a sort of mountain range running north-south parallel to the coast of Portugal, and it creates a rain shadow. So if you go beyond those mountains, you get into what's technically a semi-desert. And obviously, if you don't give vines enough water, they tend to produce a lot less fruit, but the fruit is a lot more concentrated. Anyway, right. The resulting wine that they found and transported from that region was hugely better than the stuff from the coast, and it became almost a sort of an overnight success. The first shipments of port from the upper Douro kicked off what was, you know, almost a gold rush. People poured into the region, and for the next 100 years, port just grew and grew and grew to become the most consumed and the most expensive wine in the world. I mean, it was extraordinary to think of it today. It's a small part of the whole wine world. But right. One of the things that made port different was this higher level of sugar, natural sugar in the grapes, turns into a higher level of finished alcohol in the fermented wine when you ferment it dry. And that acts as a natural preservative. So these wines did last longer than the French red or something, which back in those days, you know, you could keep it in the barrel for maybe 2 or 3 months, but after that it would turn to vinegar. Right. Whereas port had naturally a better track record. And they went one step further. They because it was a bit further to take wine from Portugal to the UK, which is the biggest market back then, than it was from France, there was a practice called fortification, where they dashed the wine with brandy. They put a bit of brandy into the cask of port before it sailed, and that acted as a preservative. It killed off any yeast that might provoke a secondary fermentation, so the wine basically wouldn't turn into vinegar. And this today is how we make port. We add a brandy spirit, which allows us to arrest the fermentation, keep some of that natural grape sugar. So port has no sweetness added to it. It's just natural grape sugar. So if you have a glass of port, you say, "Oh gosh, this is sweet." It's the same sweetness that that you would have had if you'd had a glass of grape juice. It's not added.
Right. So a couple of quick questions. When you moved towards port for the grapes, they were initially growing the grapes closer to Porto. And they were growing it closer, and were they different types of grapes?
I think they were. I mean, I think Warren Company started in 1670 in Vienna, which is a town about an hour north of here. And it basically, wine tended to come from places where you could get ships close to the right. vineyard, because wine is heavy. And I think the Douro came quite late in the history of wine, because it was very difficult to transport the wine out of the Douro. Port merchants managed. Sorry, carry on.
I didn't mean to interrupt, but talk about that when you finish your thought, because you may have said it, but the vineyards are incredibly hilly, and that makes it difficult to farm. And, you know, I guess the hilliness, the altitude, all of that has the effect on what grape and, you know, what type of, you know, wine comes out of that.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look really at the history of port, it's almost miraculous that port was ever invented in the first place, because to establish vineyard in the Douro, you have to build, you know, these steep, steep slopes. You originally, you had to build a stone wall, fill that wall with earth, plant a varietal, hope that it grew, because there's very little rainfall there. You'd probably have to water it, carry water up from the river. And then having transported the grapes by mule to the local winery, which was basically a couple of stone tanks in the middle of nowhere, you'd then have to transport the made wine on donkey back to the river. And the port merchants, the early port growers, employed these flat-bottomed wooden boats, transport boats, barges almost, that would float the wine down the river to a porto, where it could be put on the larger ocean-going vessels. So The whole logistics of the port trade was just ridiculously complicated. And I think this, you know, I alluded earlier to port having been one of the most famous and most expensive wines in the world. That profit that was possible, you know, paid for a lot of the logistics that,
right,
you know,
it was necessary.
And they say that, you know, thousands of stonemasons were brought in from Galicia in Spain, and they were known for their skills as stonemasons. Galicia at the time was very, very impoverished. So the Douro had, I don't know, someone calculated, literally thousands, tens of thousands of miles of dry stone walling was created to make the terraces for the port vineyards. And I think someone said if you took them all, put them end to end, it would wrap around the world a couple of times. You know, it was, it was that amazing amount of labor.
It's an amazing sight, you know, when you're at any one high point and look, you know, both ways, and then just going up and down the river. While we're talking about the vineyards, you know, which in reality is farming and growing a fruit, talk to me about your vineyard practices. You know, practicing organics, how important is sustainability? How do you, you know, execute those things?
Well, we're for many, many years, we've been using a local standard of minimum intervention. So we've been trying to respect the, you know, the soil, the landscape. Luckily, where we are, one of the upsides of having a very dry climate is that we don't have a lot of problems with, you know, bugs and weeds to the extent that they do in other regions. And what we have got a substantial holdings now of fully organic vineyard, where we go by the rules, and there are certain products that you absolutely can't use any weed killers or insecticides, and you can only use to treat the vineyard certain recommended traditional chemical treatments. And that's, I think we all love it. I mean, it inevitably, organic vineyard is more expensive to maintain. And but we have had some success. We now make a small amount of organic port, but a rather larger amount of fully organic table wine. That's a, you know, it's hugely satisfying, really, to know what's being done. In all the other vineyards that aren't organically farmed, as I say, that it's to all intents and purposes, you know, we're not putting anything nasty in there. So they probably could be organic, but then going through the certification process tends to be a little bit challenging. So we are passing more and more vineyards slowly to fully organic status.
Right. I read something interesting. Is it true that each family member, and, you know, as you said before, there's a bunch of active members in the family and the business, farms their own vineyards, and each port comes from individual vineyards?
Each family member has created, you know, or has bought a vineyard of their own. My father bought a vineyard back in 87, which I now share with him. And, you know, it's a modest, we work in pipes, which are barrels of port. So you measure a vineyard by the number of pipes, barrels it produces. Very archaic, but quite useful if you know the language. But in all honesty, most port is still non-vineyard specific. Port is a bit like champagne, where there's some vineyard specific wines, but the vast majority of port is is made from grapes grown by thousands of farmers in the region.
Right.
What we've tried to do with our vintage ports, our top end ports, they're 100% now from our own properties. That allows us much more control over when to pick, when to, you know, the treatment during the year. We can guarantee to produce, you know, fabulous grapes. But we still have some great farmers who we support. I mean, the Douro is a, you know, it's a one crop territory, town exactly. Yeah. There isn't really anything else you can do there. There's a few olive trees and a few almond trees, but they don't really produce. The economic benefit of the Douro is 95% down to the wine. We are conscious we want to support farmers, and as nice as it would be to make all our port from all our own vineyards, I think we'd have to have a size of property. We'd be probably the biggest landholders in Europe if we had to do that. And as nice as that would be, I don't think it's going to happen.
So that's a good thing. You're able to make your high-end ports with, I guess you could say, estate-grown grapes, and you're able to support, you know, the farmers and the communities for the demand, you know, for other, you know, bottlings, correct?
That's absolutely correct. And more and more we realize, you know, we've there are some structural problems in the Douro. You know, farmers' incomes are not going up, unfortunately. And we just can't, you know, we can't just pay indefinitely higher and higher prices, because obviously there has to be a price at which we buy grapes. You know, we can't go to the US consumer and double the prices of our wines. But there's a sort of, I think we're seeing now the light at the end of the tunnel. You know, there are farmers. I think there's the trouble of the Douro. There's been a lot of what we call weekend farmers, people who have a piece of land and they don't pay themselves any money. They just go and farm it at the weekend and they deliver the grapes. And those sort of people, you know, they're not going to survive, because once they don't have the, you know, they could never afford to put someone in to do it for them. So from that point of view, it's a bit, you know, unfortunately a bit, a bit precarious, but we became a B corporation last year, which is, you know, it's an international standard of you know, where a company, you know, we actually change our articles of association to actually, you know, we have a pledge that we will try and respect our suppliers, our customers, our community, and we're working quite hard to change the things in the Douro to make it better for everybody.
And that's called a B Corp certification. You mentioned grapes, and it would be hard not to talk about port without talking about grapes. You know, people who know wine but don't get nerdy about it don't realize that there's a whole set of grapes, you know, that port is made from that maybe the average guy never heard of. Talk to me about the grapes used to make port, you know, the grapes you're committed to growing, you know, in the Douro. Give me some names.
So we have a bunch of pretty strangely named grapes in the Douro. I like to say that they've all evolved pretty much as hybrids of the original vines that the Romans brought from Italy across France and Spain and eventually planted in Portugal. You know, it's well documented that the Romans were the ones who propagated vine growing outside Italy. And I think the common thread of these varietals that we have today, there are something like 50 different varietals around in the Douro, but we've chosen of the red varieties, we have five or six that we really like and we think can really deliver the right quality, and we don't bottle any of them on their own as port. We always blend them. But names like Tarija Nacional, Tarija Franca, Tinta Barroca, Tinta Rorige, Tinta Kaung, Tinta Morella, these are varietals. They each have, I mean, for each one, I like to describe Tarija Nacional as a bit like our Cabernet. It doesn't taste like Cabernet, but it's a structured, right, very dark, and it's the wine with a lot of sort of good acidity and firmness. Tarija Franca is maybe a bit more like Merlot. It's a little bit softer, more. And then Tinta Barroca is a bit like Zinfandel. It's high in alcohol, thin-skinned, and they all give their contribution. The nice thing about the Douro is no two harvests are the same. We have weather conditions can be absolutely totally different from year to year. So, and in different conditions, different varietals do better or worse. So there's no formula, there's no recipe for the varietals that we use. We do plant new ones. We've got Alicante Boucher from as a new varietal. We plant a little bit of Sauzang, which is a vigne verd, a red vigne verd grape that we actually have great results with in the Douro. So we're always experimenting, but there's a core of maybe five or six varietals that do 90% of the donkey work.
And the blending for each port, vintage to vintage, varies by grape percentage, right?
Exactly, depending on which grape varietals have done better. So right. the harvest that just finished, we had an absolute wipeout. We had intense heat just before the harvest, and all the Tarija Franca crop was affected. We lost about 50% of our
crop. So you'll see less Tarija Franca in that vintage,
in 2020s,
right?
Unfortunately, yeah.
So you have to tweak it where you could stay true to some type of house style, right?
Absolutely. We can say Graham's, we typically stop the fermentation a little bit sooner, so you keep more of the natural grape sugar. So Graham will naturally be a little higher, a sweeter style of port. Dow, on the other hand, we let it go the opposite way. We'll ferment a bit drier, let it ferment a bit longer, so there's a little bit less residual sugar,
right,
and a drier finish. And so that you can tweak the house style. And then obviously the properties that go into Dow and Graham, the top wines, will give their signature to the wine. So even in a tricky year from a climatic point of view, that the sort of style of the wine's underlying style will be the same. Just the varietal mix will be different.
Before we take a break, I want to talk about one last thing pertinent to all of this. And that's how the wine is made, and your cellar practices. How much different is it to make port than other wines? And foot treading, which I don't know if people know about, is something that's essential to making port. Tell me about that and some of the changes coming that way.
So winemaking has been, I mean, the original winemaking method was foot treading. That was the Roman practice, where grapes were hand carried down the hill in baskets and tipped into open stone troughs about 10 foot by 15 foot square, and maybe about 3.5 feet deep. And that would be, the grapes would be put in whole. At the end of the day, a team of about 10 or 12 people would jump into the stone tank and foot stomp those grapes for about 3 hours until the fermentation, the skins had been broken down. And then
the obvious, not to interrupt, the obvious question is, why wouldn't you press them?
Well, I think this was, we didn't have...
Tradition and history?
Yeah, well, we didn't have electricity in the Douro until the 1970s. So prior to that, there was no mechanical methods available, and people just did it the way. And it makes great wine. I mean, there were people there also. They lived out on the farms. They were quite happy to do a bit of extra work after they'd had their evening meal after picking. And, and believe it or not, we still make wine like that at our Quinta de Vesuvio. In fact, we didn't for the first time ever this year in 2020. We didn't make the wine that way because of COVID, but until 2019, we've been, you know, making wine in the time-honored way. We've made some advances. You know, we de-stem the grapes before we put them in the tank, and we cool the tank down to help it, you know, help keep the freshness in the wine. But otherwise, what happened in the 60s when it became obvious that we weren't going to be able to have a future making 100% of the wine of the Douro by foot trading? We invested, actually Dow was one of the first wineries in 1964 to put in a pump over method, more like a modern, a brilliant machine developed by an Algerian Frenchman called the Les Sols method. And it's almost like a coffee percolator where the CO2 generated by the fermentation is used to drive the fermentation pump over. So it's a no energy self-energizing process. Absolutely brilliant. But when you next come, Sam, I'll show you the machine, but I'm not going
to
try and...
I would love to see that. Does that resemble in any form what other winemakers do with carbonic maceration?
I think it's pretty unique. You know, it's quite an aggressive pump over. You know,
it sounds different.
I haven't seen it made, you know, used anywhere else in the world, and I know they stopped using it. They had a bit in North Africa, but it was considered. But anyway, more recently we've developed a substitute for foot treading, which is an automated lagar. So we've replaced the people who foot stomped with hydraulically driven feet, and these basically apply the same pressure on the skin so they don't break the seeds. They just...
Interesting.
And that's been a brilliant invention. We make some of our best wines that way today.
Interesting. Rupert, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk to you, you know, specifically about the brands and the wines. I'm talking to Rupert Symington. Rupert is the CEO of Symington Family Estates, the great port maker. You're listening to The Grape Nation. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Bin to Table, a monthly food subscription service for folks who want to cook with the best pantry ingredients on the planet, founded by Ben Simon. After working for President Obama, Ben spent 5 years traveling the world for Greenpeace, campaigning on climate change and sustainable agriculture. He always kept his eye out for delicious food to bring back home. Now, with everyone's travels on hold and home cooking more important than ever, Bin subscriptions provide a way for home cooks to experience different food cultures each month and put together nourishing, delicious meals with the best pantry items on the planet. With Taste the World, get a new shipment of different best-in-class ingredients to explore a new cuisine each month, along with tips and tricks to help out. We're talking delicious, single-origin spices, cold-pressed olive oil, beautiful sauces, and lots of ways to use them. There's also an essential subscription which gets you a delicious assortment of heirloom, hard-to-find recipe staples. You can also get both each month with the full Bin-to-Table box subscription. Learn more at bin2table.com and use the code HRN at checkout to get $20 off your first month, and Bin-to-Table will donate $10 to HRN.
Okay, we're back. We're back with my guest, Rupert Symington. Rupert runs Symington Family Estates with his family. Rupert, we talked about port, how it's made the region and all of that. Now let's talk about your brands. There are some revered, venerable brands. I think the cornerstone flagship is the port. You have four port houses. Please tell me, you know, who they are again. You've mentioned them during the show, but let's talk about them. And just give me a little brief difference. Like in the port itself, you talked about the difference between, you know, Dows and Grahams. You know, what other nuances or subtleties, you know, with each of the houses?
So we Grahams is obviously, I think, our flagship brand.
Okay.
I'm hoping even through COVID, as of the last figures I saw, I'm hoping that Graham it will have grown in the US this year by about over 10%, which is amazing. Just shows really? That when people are at home, they do wicked things like drinking port. You know? and that makes it probably the biggest brand in the US now by value, and that is reflected across our whole portfolio. It's the brand that we probably have. You know, it's more exposure, more fine dining associated with the brand. But we also right. have a healthy base of luckily retail distribution. Graham tends to be a sweeter, richer, perhaps a more lush style of port. Its stablemate Dow typically would be a little bit drier. A bit more muscular, lean in a Dow vintage port. Quite often you could have the first sip and it's sweet, but it finishes almost like a Bordeaux, you know, it's almost like a dry right. wine. You almost no lingering sweetness. And then Coburn, the newest kid on the block for us.
The new old kid.
Well, exactly. Coburn was added to the family stable only in 2010. And that's got a also on the drier side, but it sources a lot of its fruit from the upper Douro. The Douro runs east-west through the Spanish plain, and it goes through the Douro Valley, mountainous Douro Valley, when it reaches Portugal. And Coburn has a lot of properties and sources a lot of grapes from upstream, sort of closer to the Spanish border where it's hotter and drier. So you get definitely more of quite often a sort of Kirsch cherry stone right. quality in the wine, also a little bit drier. And it's also a big proponent of the Tarriga Nacional variety, which is actually Coburn's almost single-handedly rescued in the Douro in the 1970s. It was a varietal that almost disappeared from the Douro and Coburn.
Is there a higher blend of the Nacional in the Coburns?
In the Coburn vintage, definitely. We have a dominant percentage of Tarriga Nacional right. in almost every vintage now. And then, last but not least, is War, one of my personal favorites. War has a sort of a winery that's cooler, higher up in the hill, and some vineyards which are higher up. And it makes very floral, very sort of flowery and fruit forward wines, perhaps not as chunky as a Dow, but you know, amazingly elegant and lifted. I'm drinking at the moment out of preference. I took home a case of 94 vintage, and the wine is absolutely phenomenal. I mean, it's just perfect age. You know, it was same age as my son Hugh. It's 26 years old. And it's just spectacular. I mean, for drinking today, there's nothing better.
So there's kind of a port within, you know, Symington for every type of style and taste. Tell me about, you're also making non-port wines, right? I mean, a lot of the Quintas are making wine. Has that been a growing thing through the years?
Absolutely. I mean, as we grew our vineyard holdings throughout the 90s and 2000s, or noughties as they call them, we came up with a challenge, which was in the port trade or in the Douro, there's a law that each vineyard has only a certain volume that it can make into port. Anything else grown over and above, or any kilos over and above the limit, would have to be fermented into dry wine. And this was, as we added vineyard holdings, we were growing more and more quality grapes that weren't allowed legally to be made into port. So in 1999, actually, I led a team to kind of develop some dry wines, and we didn't have a lot of experience. In fact, we had no experience of making quality reds. We made some sort of reds as secondary out of the leftover grapes, but nothing that we were really very proud of. And one of the things we had a friendship with the Prats family, who'd recently sold Costa d'Estournelle. We were together
legendary.
In this wonderful group called Primum Familii Vini, along with the Antinoris and others. And Bruno Prats agreed to come and work with us in 99 to try and develop an equivalent to Vintage Port in a dry red. So we gave him, you know, free access to our top grapes from our top vineyards, Malvedos, Vesuvio, Bonfing. And we made experimental wines in 99. And in 2000, you know, we launched Crisea, which was an absolute overnight success. You know, it was a really, you know, big blackstrap quality red wine from the region made from the top grapes. So I think we started off, I think, at the right end. We also developed a more commercial range, which probably took a bit longer to get going. But I'm happy to say that today, I'm looking at for this year, we will sell over 200,000 cases, 9 liters of dry reds from the Douro this year, dry reds and whites, which will be a record for my family.
Now, one last thing. You've always worked out of Porto and the Douro, but the family recently expanded into another very interesting region of Portugal called Alentejo. Tell me about that quickly.
So we've been sort of looking at, you know, we've all had all our eggs firmly in one basket. We've had an investment in Madeira for some years, but other than that, we haven't had any vineyard ownership outside the Douro Valley. So we thought, as a hedge, you know, we should look at some diversification. Anyway, about 4 or 5 years ago, we had the opportunity to acquire a very significant 40 hectare vineyard in a 200 hectare property in this curious mountain range east of Lisbon called the Serra de San Mamed. It forms pretty much the border between Spain and Portugal. And it's a vineyard shelf, a bit like you get in Napa Valley. It's a flat bit of land about 500 meters up from the plain. And on it is a wonderful vineyard. It's pretty flat, where we have Cabernet, we have Syrah, we have Alfrecheiro, the Varietal, we have some about 10% white grapes, including Arinto and Verdelho. And we've been making since 2017 some really spectacular wines. I mean, we literally bought it without any stock. We bought a vineyard and a winery and a property. We didn't know what the potential of the wines would be. So there was an element of gambling, but I'm really pleased. You know,
What is the name of the vineyard?
We call it Quinta do Font Soto, which means
S-O-U-T-O.
S-O-U-T-O. It means the source of the Soto stream. And a Soto is a chestnut grove, and the property is covered in chestnut trees. Where there aren't vineyards, there are chestnuts. And we thought it was we changed the name because we didn't buy the brand. We just bought the property. And the original name of the property was something unpronounceable. So, but I'm very pleased actually, and I think it's a model that, you know, in the fullness of time, you know, we'd like to replicate in other regions. I mean, there's so much in Portugal that's wonderful, and I have to say this is by far the best area of the Alentejo. It's high, it's cool, it's got schistous soils. It's much more akin to what we do in the Douro than the rest of the Alentejo, which is, you know, Alentejo makes great wines, but a lot of them are from much higher yielding vines and you know, much more commercial styles. So, you know, we've picked a fantastic terroir. So watch this space. I think it's
looking forward to tasting that. Rupert, I do a thing called the wine list where I ask all my guests about their wine preferences. We'll do that in a minute, but I have a couple of questions, more than a couple, that I want you to answer quickly. What is the right temperature to serve port to enjoy?
I would say, you know, room temperature, you know, I can't remember what it is in Fahrenheit, but 16 degrees.
I'll convert that. Okay. So 16 degrees Fahrenheit.
So centigrade. You know, I would say, you know, room temperature, or in the case of a tawny, I like it maybe a little cooler in the summer. You know, it's a little touch of, you know, white wine temperature is probably perfect in the summer.
Now, tell people the difference. I mean, you're not confused, but people sometimes look at port and they look at sherry and they go, oh, those are two sweet things. Aren't they the same? What's the difference between port and sherry?
Well, sherry is made almost entirely out of white grapes, right. And port is made almost entirely out of red grapes. So that's a good start.
Right.
But they share the heritage. Both were fortified wines, really created in order to help the wines travel. But that's where the similarity ends.
Is sherry heated, Rupert?
I don't believe so. No. I think that's just Madeira.
Just Madeira.
But I think sherry is, you know, is fermented off the skins using this strange yeast called Flor, which floats on the top of the. Whereas port, we use wild yeasts naturally present on the skins, and obviously we have a lot of skin contact. All the flavor in a port grapes is in the skin, so we've got to, you know, really use a very aggressive. These small grapes, drought-stricken grapes, are very low on juice and the skins are very thick. So it takes a lot of work to get all that color and flavor out of the skin. So we have to work it pretty hard.
And then the last thing is, when people think of wine, it's made annually. It's marked with a vintage year, good or bad, you know, whatever Mother Nature throws. It's a little different with port because you or whatever organization declares a port vintage. Is that correct? And explain that for me.
So we recognize that in the Douro, being a region that's has a lot of variation from year to year in weather conditions, that we make good wines every year, but we make really outstanding wines about once every 3 or 4 years. And that's been that realization gave rise to a I think what I call a very honorable tradition, which was to not to ask people every year to buy the wine like the Bordelais do at the same price or higher, even though the quality may be lower. So the port trade from about 1870 elected to not offer the wines unless they were outstanding. And this is what we call declaration. We declare that we believe the wine is good enough to be sold at the high price. And so we tend typically only offer it once every 3 or 4 years. Very occasionally, we'll offer 2 years in a row, and that happened in 2016 and 2017. It hadn't happened since the 1930s. So, you know, it's something that, you know, it's a bit like, you know, having favorite children. You know, there's nothing wrong with either of them, but one of them might just be showing a little bit better on the day. And in this case, they were both. They were both so good, we didn't have a contest. So, you know.
All right, let's talk about children. One of the nice things about your business, it's a family business. Your son, Hugh, who you mentioned is in his mid-20s, is working with you. I hope he's bringing a younger perspective to the business. The question that I want to throw out, you know, which may play Hugh into it, and certainly you must be thinking about, is I think port has this perception, you know, as an older beverage, and you know, the guy with the smoking jacket, you know, with the special glass and maybe a cigar. Are you trying to, and will you, and how can you market port to a younger audience?
I think that's a very good question. I mean, I think, you know, I always like to say that, you know, port became famous not because people put it on TV or Instagram, but because it was good. And you know, I think that wine consumers of all generations come into wine at a pretty basic level. I mean, we all drink our first glass of wine when we're at college or maybe a bit before, and then we'll probably buy, you know, we drink beer at college, and then once we've got a bit of money, we will maybe buy a supermarket bottle. And then once we feel comfortable about our finances, and we maybe start investing in some more expensive, you know, single village wines from the Rhone, or, you know, and then we'll graduate to port. So, you know, the younger people have never drunk port. I mean, I think what we're talking about here is making sure that when those younger people who are current younger people get older, that they will drink port. And we're doing a lot of that through.
So that's the reality of, you know, what the beverage is, you know, that's how it plays to the market.
Exactly. To some extent. I don't think that, you know, obviously we want to expose young people as early as possible to the joys of port. I remember having a wonderful dinner in Los Angeles a few years ago, and a wine dinner, and this kid who she was maybe 22 years old just came up to me and just said, I've discovered, you know, Graham's 20 year old. It's just, you know, this is my drink. You know, this is what I've been looking for all my life. And okay, she'd maybe had a couple of glasses by then, but it's still very, it was very heartening to hear that, you know, that somebody really, you know, of that age really engaged with, you know, the product. It wasn't to do with what, you know, who drank it or whether it's people in smoking jackets, or it was the product is really good. And I think that continues to be, so we're making sure the packaging is getting more contemporary. The occasion for drinking, we're saying, look, don't wait till, you know,
you birthday have a or party. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Just anytime it's a good time to drink port. So
I think Hugh will be able to help you with that. All right, Rupert, we have less than 8 minutes left. I need to accomplish two things in those 8 minutes. So I want you to be cooperative. I want you to answer my wine list. I'm going to shoot you 5 questions. I ask every guest the same 5 questions. I post them on our social media. It's always great to hear, you know, what our guests are drinking and, you know, people like you in that part of the world, you know, entrenched in port. So the first question is, what are you drinking now? What's on your table? What's in your fridge? What are you experimenting with? What are the season changes bringing?
So at home, I'm a primarily red wine drinker, and I'm a Rhone nut. I love anything to do with North or South Rhone. I just love the whole earthiness.
You're preaching to the choir, Rupert.
It's just
I prefer Northern a little more, but love both.
But it just, you know, that I love that rusticity and that, you know, vines that put their roots deep to get, you know, minerals, and that's what I love, you know. And that's not to say that I haven't discovered great wines from other parts of the world, but you know, I like to drink wine every day. I like to drink a different wine every day. And in living in Portugal, we don't have a huge amount of stuff from other regions available. You know, when I travel to California, I typically bring back 12 bottles of assorted California reds just to have something different. And I pop up to Spain, which is only an hour from here, you know, to buy stuff at the supermarket there, and I buy Riojas and Tempranillos. Sure. And you know, I think you know, at home I'm you know, I'd love to love white wine more, but I'm not really sort of, you know,
you sound like me.
Got more pleasure out of the red.
Nothing against it, just not drinking enough. All right, Rupert Simonton's favorite wine and food pairing. Is there something, you know, throughout that you've always loved? Don't necessarily eat it every night, every month, but what's a great wine and food pairing of yours?
Okay, so my rotisserie attachment to my Weber gets a lot of use in the summer, and that is the food is a no-brainer, and if you wash it down with a Coudelet de Bucastel from Perrin, you know, that's an unbelievable food and wine pairing. I think that's, you know, one of the best dishes and one of the best.
I agree. And I know the Perrins are part of the Primum family Vinay, which is a nice thing. All right. Help me with this. You know, a lot of my guests are in and around New York, the United States. You're not there. Your favorite wine restaurant and or bar, who's somebody that's doing wine really well? Selection, you know, environment to sit down, knowledgeable staff. Is there anything in Gaia, Porto, Douro, you know, that stands out to you?
I have to say, preaching from our own hymn sheet, we just opened a pop-up restaurant with a local chef called Pedro Lemos, who's Porto-based chef. He's from the Douro originally. And he set up this amazing bread oven that he kind of built.
Neat.
You know, and he's been doing, we opened this restaurant in July, and it's extraordinary. He's putting, you know, local, local duck rice, you know, in the oven and toasting it. He even did octopus the other day, just with a little crispy
charred.
So simple. I mean, there's, you know, there's no kind of Michelin star about it. It's just
brilliant. It sounds great. All right, now fourth question, fourth of five. Your favorite all-time wine. I always told everyone when I put this question on the list years ago, we've been doing the podcast for 4 years, that I was kind of fishing for people's rarest, most expensive wine they ever had. The question is more morphed into, Rupert, what's that wine that was important to you, that was transitional, that, you know, had an effect on you, still does? You know, so your favorite all-time wine is really, what's the wine that moved you the most or is just still that memorable?
Yeah, I think my father, about 7 or 8 years ago, had my three kids and my wife and my mother around the table. And he said, I've got something special. And he'd opened a bottle of Wars 1908 that had been in his father's cellar. And he just said, you know, I'm not sure this wasn't 2008 that he opened it. And he said, you know, this is a wine that's 100 years old. You know, I'd like you to taste this with me, you know. And it was very emotional, actually, to, you know, have three generations of a wine family drinking a wine together. You know, it was probably not the greatest wine I've ever had. It was great.
No, you understand the point of the question now? It wasn't, you know, the 45 Aubryon. It was, you know, that particular wine. And that's what I was looking for. The last question is, and I don't want to get into this one because I want to taste the wine quickly because we're running out of time, is I always ask my guests to recommend the best wine around $15, $20 American, a red and a white. Categorically, you know, there are things like Muscadet that are always cheap. What can you think of as, you know, a great value red and a great value white? Could be anywhere around the world, could be from you, could be from any other maker. Does anything come to mind?
I think I have to say those Alsace white Rieslings are just, you know, they're so undervalued and so
great,
you know,
answer.
Really, you know, wine's really substantial. They have, the Alsacians always believe that their wines go with Chinese food, which is great. I mean,
they go so Traminer too. Yeah.
Yeah. They go so well. And then in terms of red, I have to say, a bottle of my partnership with Bruno Prats, Prazo de Rorige, you know, for about $17. I mean, it's
a
good glass of wine. You know, it's a red.
I'm glad I didn't realize it was there. And like I said, you know, I'm going to post your answers and, you know, we post specific brands. Great job on that. Rupert, we literally have a minute or so left. Every week we do a segment called the Weekly Wine Sip where we get a chance to taste wine. And usually if I have a guest that makes wine, we'll taste it. You were kind enough to drop off a Grams 20-year-old Tawny Porto. Just tell me a little about this wine.
So this is a wine that's been in the barrel since the harvest 20 years ago. It's been moved down to a Porto when it was about 2 or 3 years old, and it's been sitting in the coastal climate, which is a lot more humid and cooler than the Douro, for 24 years. And it's a wine that basically has being in barrels, being a higher alcohol wine, it hasn't oxidized like it would have done if it had been a red wine.
Right.
The water and the alcohol in the wine have evaporated and oxygen has come into the wine. So it's gained a little bit of oxidative quality. It's gained concentration. And you get this almost liqueur-like, you know, effect.
Mouthfeel, smell, you know, the whole thing.
The primary purple fruit has morphed into raisins and Christmas pudding, and you know, it's got a lot of kind of structure. But it's a pale brown wine. The word tawny means literally brown.
Right, versus the ports, which have, you know, the red, ruby red color. And
exactly.
The darker, yeah.
And in terms of the nose, there's definitely, you know, there's age, there's wood. This is a wine you can buy. I mean, I went around a couple of years ago, and I was in a wine store casually looking at prices, and you can't get sort of second or third tier Napa wines, Cabernets, for much less than $60. No. And this wine you can buy for about $65. I mean, it's such a deal. Yeah. 20 years in the cellar, and this sort of, you know, this is a Graham 20-year-old. It's a, you know, I think one of my favorite. This is my go-to wine at home. I keep a bottle in the fridge all year round.
The 20 even more than the 30 or the 40. You just like the 20 is settled in.
The 20 still has enough of the primary fruit. You know, it's the 30 or 40 are fabulous wines, but they're right. You know, they're more of a sort of special occasion wine.
Right. This is very drinkable.
What do you
pair this with, or what do you drink it with? When do you drink it?
I drink this typically after dinner.
Okay, so aperitif.
If I'm having it at dinner, then I recommend you have it with something like a tarte tatin or a creme brulee, something with a little caramel or pastry. That's the traditional. It's such a good match. You know, this wine has been a big hit in restaurants in the U.S. because, you know,
I could see why. It is very delicious and very drinkable. That is the Graham's 20-year-old Tawny Porto. Just one last question that I got to wrap up. Is this blended vintages, or it's 20 years and stays from the barrel on?
This is blended vintages. So there's a master lot, which is about 25 years.
Okay, so the oldest vintage is that.
Yeah,
got
so
it.
25-year-old lot, and it's kind of a mixture. And then we blend back with slightly younger wines to freshen up the blend. But the average age of this is about 23 years, I think.
It's terrific, and it is a great value. Rupert, we got to wrap up. That went very quick. I have a million more questions. Hopefully, we can get to it another time. If you have a suggestion, question, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's Sam at the Grape Nation. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. On Instagram, we're at SBenRuby. On Twitter, we're at BenRuby. But you can always use the hashtag The Grape Nation on both. As I mentioned, we will post Rupert's wine list answers and the weekly wine sip that we sip today on our social media sites. Rupert, if people want more information about, you know, any of the Symington wines, where's the best place for them to go?
Go on to Symington.com. That's our main company website. There's a Symington Family Estates Facebook page, Instagram. We've got lots of different, you know, it's all listed on the site, but start at Symington.com.
And I want to say on the Symington Family Estates site, you know, we talked about Dowers, all that. Everything is prominently represented and has, you know, information on each one. So if anything we talked about, you know, is of interest to you, you go right into that Symington thing and it'll take you to wherever you want. Rupert, I want to thank you very much for taking time out of a busy life. I was going to ask you how the pandemic affected you guys, but you kind of weaved in, you know, the effects it's had on you. I hope you stay safe and well. So thank you to our guest, Rupert Symington. Thank you to our engineer, Amanda, and everyone at the Heritage Radio. I'm Sam BenRuby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks, Sam.
The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.